Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic, Behind the Page. The air is getting cooler, the leaves are turning crisp and bright, fall has truly begun to arrive. But before we settle into the season, let's go over His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation one more time. So, this is something I don't usually do, but I'm running a Goodreads page, and I was adding this book to my list of books that I have read. And I went ahead and took a look at the reviews for this book, and I found something that was a little bit surprising. Clearly, Maisie Yates has a lot of fans, otherwise she would not be where she is today. But in all of the reviews for His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation, I noticed something. They all seem to have expected a pregnancy at the end, and many were disappointed that there was not a pregnancy at the end. So clearly, this must be a calling card if everyone was expecting it from this author. So it also reminded me that she's written, as of this podcast, over 100 books. This was, I think, last year, almost, if not at the very earliest this year, so she's obviously written more. And since she started writing in 2010, that's roughly 9 to 10 books a year. And for what it's worth, I find that remarkable. Yeah, the books are short. Most Harlequins are. But that is still a hugely impressive work ethic. So in the month of November every year, there's a writing challenge called National Novel Writing Month, in which authors and writers challenge themselves to write a 50,000-word novel in the space of a month of November, which is essentially 30 days. That is a challenge, mind you. People are crunching and slamming their noses to the grindstone when they do this. It's not the norm. I actually did it once on my own and not in November, and that turned out a novel that will never see the light of day. Assuming Maisie Yates writes a minimum 50,000 words in each of her books, that doesn't leave a lot of time for polishing and editing. But she's also been doing this for 10 years, so she probably has her schedule down to a science. Again, I swear, I am not bitter about this. I am simply in awe of the act of her churning out 10 books in a year. However, that does kind of leave the question of quality versus quantity. When I really think about this book and looking back at what I was reading, it almost felt a little bit like a Mad Libs game. Because kind of when I think about it, it almost felt like our hero is Prince Blank from the Kingdom of Blank, and he has tragedy in his past in the form of Blank, where he meets a lady from background of Blank. It's a lot. But it also kind of felt like she's either pulling attributes out of a hat or she's throwing darts at a board to figure out what puzzle pieces she's going to use. Because in some ways, it feels a little bit cookie cutter, you know? Like she collects all of these different attributes and she writes a story that uses these things. That's really the only way that I could reasonably understand how a woman who is completely uncomfortable in court life and loves animals falls in love with a king who hates cats. The relationship is really strange to me. I kind of don't see a future for our couple. I mentioned in the podcast where Alex walks into her cottage and he's literally above her. He stands above her. And it's a screaming metaphor of him above her in station and in life. And I could not get that out of my head. And Tinley is shown to us to be uncomfortable in court in general. She doesn't really like the pomp and circumstance. She's never really been comfortable doing, like, I guess the trappings, doing the trappings that, yeah, sure, that makes sense. Being in court in general, she's just not comfortable with it. She really didn't either adjust to the court life in the book either. She's been living in the castle for years. She just kind of tolerates it a little bit. So even though she grew up in the palace, it's not a big stretch for her to be able to walk into a royal role because she was expected to fill that. But she didn't want to, so it didn't make a lot of sense for me. And of course, Alex himself, he was incredibly careless with his wandering gaze that he couldn't control himself around his brother's intended fiancé. A fiancé, by the way, if I'm remembering my book correctly, was barely 18 by the time Dionysius died. They don't mention Alex's age in the book, and I've noticed that that's not typical to say something about the age of the men, especially. Women, they might mention it, but the men, they, it's kind of general. But I think it was inferred that he was at least in his early 30s, and Tinley was not yet 23. I know, age is just a number, but that's an age gap that I am not a big fan about, especially the way that they were considering that Tinley has to get married. She is being forced to become married by the age of 23, and she was already intended to marry somebody else who she was technically in love with, and if she doesn't get married, she doesn't get to inherit anything. The setup kind of felt a little sloppy, I guess, because Tinley was obviously loved by her father, right? So he managed to set her up a betrothal with the second-born son of the king. Despite what her mother thinks, that's a big deal. To be a princess in marriage is pretty big, even if you're not going to be queen. And I get the feeling that Tinley did not want to be queen anyway. So Dionysius died, and her father still wanted her to be taken care of, so for some reason, there's this clause in his estate where she doesn't get to inherit anything unless she gets married by the age of 23. Why? That one is just wild to me. It's like, you obviously cared about your daughter, and you did it well enough that you were able to get her a match with a friggin' prince, but you're not going to let her get married, or you're not going to let her not get married because her fiancé died, unless, yeah, it's a lot. And yeah, there is a lot happening in this book, but I don't know if that's because the author is busy churning out formulaic books at a breakneck speed, or if it's just her style of writing. Again, I am in awe of her work ethic, and as far as I can tell, she's not using a ghostwriter. According to her, it can take between 3 to 6 weeks for a first draft. But what would happen if she took several months on a manuscript instead of just one? I don't know. I'm not criticizing her. Absolutely not. But aspects of the book felt a little rough around the edges. Case in point, that whole will estate thing that I mentioned. And when we really think about it, the need for Tinley to inherit anything just kind of flies out the window when she's getting ready to marry the king of an entire country. She won't need anything after that. Yeah. And of course, again, we have this loss of agency. Tinley is talking to Alex before the ball, saying she's like, I would like some decision. I would like to have some input on the individual that I'm going to marry. And Alex is like, yeah, sure, that's fine. I totally understand. And then the night of the ball, he completely rips that away from her, saying, by the way, I've invited you all here with the intention of telling you that you might be a possible suitor, but never mind, I'm going to do it instead. And he never told Tinley that he was going to do this. Can we let the women make their own decisions? Like, really? Like, she doesn't have any say about his reactions to her. At least he lets her keep her pets as much as he complained about them. I guess that's a thing. Yeah. That's a thing. So before you think that I totally hate this thing, what was excellent was that bath scene. I've already talked about this in the episode, so I'm not going to get too much further into it. But it was almost like a screenplay in a way. I could very easily see the scenario play out in my mind, scene by scene, and I knew the tone that the author was going for. Like I said, this is probably where the author makes her money and why she has written 100 books with Harlequin. The sex was compelling, artistic, and tasteful. It's exactly what I would expect from the Harlequin books. It will be a long time before I forget that image of a woman coming out of the steam like she walked out of a man's imagination to reality for the sole purpose of tempting him to sin. Now, I did mention that I tried to read the second book first. That's kind of where I first ran into some of that choppy prose. In the first few pages of that second book, I ran into that dreamlike prose that suggested an alternate fantasy or historical setting, but I got thrown into modern terms that contradicted that perception, like they were talking about America. That just kind of blew my mind a little bit. I wasn't expecting it. And to add to the confusion, Lazarus appeared to be staging a coup against Alex. His justifications for said coup implied that Alex was a villain, along with the entire royal family. So I knew I had to go back and read the first one just to kind of get a handle on what would happen in the second one. Now, of course, after reading Alex's story, I am not totally convinced that Lazarus wasn't somewhat justified. Oh, hello, Hermes. This is what I get for trying to record very close to dinner time. Anyway, I was frustrated. I'm sure that I would have been fine if I had gone on to read the entire book. That's kind of the magic of romance novels with long-running series. They tend to not need to see the subsequent beginnings. But I really, really wanted a baseline for the world that I was going to get into, so I resigned to reading the first one. That proved to be a little bit of a challenge because Harlequin no longer carries physical copies, and I wanted this episode to come out on a certain date. Essentially, I had to pay for the book twice. I purchased an ebook from Harlequin, and then I ordered a physical copy from a different online retailer. I mentioned in that episode that I insist on having physical copies, and I really do mean that. When I talk about things like the Shelf of Shame or the Gold Star Shelf, they aren't digital or even mental classifications. I have an entire bookshelf that I ran out to IKEA to get specifically for this purpose, and it's got designated shelf space for each of the three levels. Gold, Shame, and then all the others waiting for their turn, and then all of the others that I've already read. I'm very visual in many ways, and it's been a real joy for me to watch this shelf fill up with the books that I've read and with the books I will read for the podcast. So that does limit me in a way. If I can't have a physical copy, it'll be hard to justify its appearance on the podcast because I need that visual representation that it became part of Hopelessly Romantic, and also that it was easily accessible for other folks to read. And another thing is that it's also really hard for me to focus on ebooks when I'm reading. When ebooks first came out, I thought they were pretty cool, pretty brilliant, but now that I have them on my phone instead of a dedicated e-reader, I can hardly sit still long enough to read one for some reason. I don't know why, but there's that. And that also eliminates the Harlequin imprint that I have been curious about, the Dare series. So His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation had something that I was surprised to see, that ever so slight toe dipping into domination and submission. It is extremely subtle, but it's there. And I would have liked to have seen if Harlequin dipped further into those waters. If my research is correct, the Dare imprint was exactly that. It promises more explicit content, even if not full-blown BDSM. But it had a short life. It began in 2018 and ended production this year in June. I'm not sure if they published physical copies, but they don't now, and alas, that removes them from my running. There is also Harlequin's digital imprint, Carina Press, which looks to be higher in the spicy ratings, but again, no physical books, which is a shame, because that looks to be where a lot of experimentation is happening. Paranormal, fantasy, LGBTQ+, these are all topics that I would love to explore on the podcast, but why wouldn't they want to publish physical books? But that doesn't mean I won't stop looking. There is plenty of exciting romance out there, and there are plenty of publishers willing to put the more exciting books on paper. So, by some minuscule chance, if the Harlequin editors and executives are listening, hey, put these books on paper. I will buy them. Anyway, what have I been reading this week? Well, I was hoping to read Truth of the Divine by Lindsay Ellis, but because the general state of shipping everywhere is terrible, the book release had to be pushed back another week. Unless you were in the UK, those lucky ducks got it when it was released, when it was supposed to release, excuse me. So I've been nibbling on a couple of things. First is How to Read Literature Like a Professor by Thomas C. Foster. I bought this book because, well, it's been a few years since my degree, and now that I'm doing literary analysis as my job, I figured I'd give my knowledge base a little bit of a dusting and a polish. But this is a very long time read for me. It's not thick, but I'm chewing on it slowly. Eventually, I'll get the companion book, How to Read Novels Like a Professor, but I gotta get through this one first. I've also been reading Winds of Fate by Mercedes Lackey. I know, big shot, I'm still reading her. But there's no audiobook available to me right now, so I'm struggling with a library ebook. That'll be another slow read as well. This one follows Harold Elspeth after the events of the Arrows trilogy. Oh boy, everyone's making noise. While she is trying to recover the magic lost by the Harold centuries ago. Eventually, I'm going to want an entire copies of this trilogy, but the bookstore never has them when I go in. And I've also been reading Wild Magic by Tamora Pierce. This is a nostalgic read for me, more comfort food than anything. But I'm listening to the audiobook, which features a full cast recording. Those are always a delight to listen to, so I'm pretty happy to take my time with Pierce. So that'll be it for this week. I hope to see you next week for a very special Halloween episode where we read Beauty and the Werewolf by Mercedes Lackey here on Hopelessly Romantic. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and also thank you for joining us with my interrupting cat again and my pups too. I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or you want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a long way to help the show, and that way I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho, and Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read. Only that it's what you love.